This week on the podcast, I've got my friend Paolo on. He's the founder of Athletic IQ. He's a comp prep coach with bodybuilding. They've been doing it for a very long time, over a decade's experience himself in just putting athlete after athlete on stage and just absolutely crushing it when it comes to bodybuilding. He himself has obviously competed in bodybuilding. He's also competed in powerlifting through the older days at Adonis Athletics. That's actually how I know him. He was a member at Adonis Athletics, and we've remained friends since we first got to know each other. Very smart guy, very evidence-based in his approach to training and nutrition. He's a great physique and bodybuilding coach. And I just want to pick his brain a little bit about his thoughts on what it takes to be successful in bodybuilding, his thoughts on coaching, and just some good chats. So tune in, guys. Let me know what you think and any feedback you got. I'm looking forward to hearing it. Enjoy. All right. Paolo, what's happening, brother?
I'm good, man. I'm good. For easy like a Sunday morning, as I told you earlier on.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for joining me on a Sunday morning. It's obviously, we see each other fairly regularly. We talk to each other on a regular basis, but I think it's important that we get together. Like, it's good to get together like this, you know, just to be able to talk about just things that is happening, whether, you know, in general or, and also things in relation to the industry and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
What's new on your end, man? Anything happening? What's happening with competitions?
Well,
bodybuilding competitions.
Comps are, it's an interesting time for competitions because a lot of them are starting to make announcements about season B. And I think even Victoria was the first one to make the announcements for season B, and then obviously they're in lockdown again, so it'll be an interesting time to see what's happening with that. But look, I mean, with everything that's happened, I've got at the moment, I've got a few people competing this season coming up, which is sort of a delayed season B, if you like. But for the most part, I've gotten most of my guys to just postpone their prep until season A next year, or even season B next year in some cases. It's one of those things where I'd rather bring them to the stage unrushed and with more prep, you know, under their belt sort of thing, because it's just going to yield a better result in the long term. So, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, speaking of that, with bodybuilders, look, with strength athletes, with strength sports, say powerlifting or strongman, the average turnaround time for comp prep is, you know, 12 weeks.
Right.
You can almost like as an average, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're a little bit more advanced, you probably need a little bit more because it takes longer to adapt. If you're much more of a beginner, you could probably get away with a little bit less time. But for the majority of the time, a 12-week period is about a good turnaround time for a comp prep period.
Yeah.
How does it work with bodybuilding? What kind of a turnaround time are we looking at?
So in powerlifting,
or the average person, you know, like somebody who's not a complete beginner, who's been training, has some muscular development, but it's certainly not, you know, advanced, hasn't been competing again and again, and you know.
Yeah, I guess it all depends on how you view what you view as sort of prep ready, if you like. So let's just really quickly analyze. When you say 12 weeks, there's already some assumed strength in there, right? So there's a basic level, intermediate to almost advanced strength levels for your average lifter before they partake in a peaking program for powerlifting, say. And what you're saying is that it takes about 12 weeks to improve on that and then peak their strength for a competition. In bodybuilding, it's somewhat similar. I mean, you can, if you've got someone who ticks the boxes, for example, if they have sufficient muscle mass, very little weak by means of weak points, you know, in their overall physique, if they
can you hear me? You're just cutting out.
Yeah. Well, okay. Cool.
Just go right back. You cut back. Just as you were about to say in bodybuilding, and you were about to begin.
Right.
Okay. Go back to that part.
Yeah. So in bodybuilding, it all comes back to what you would deem as acceptable to start a prep. So things we assess, for example, would be muscle mass. You'd want to show someone. You'd want to put someone on stage that has very little weak by means of weak points in their physique. So you know, if you've got stuff to work on and build muscle with, and they're evident weak points, and there's stuff that you're not happy with ultimately. For example, if your hamstrings are severely underdeveloped, or if you don't have a very good V taper, or if your shoulders are disproportionate to the size of your arms and your chest, it's probably not a good idea to start a prep. But if you were to, for example, tick all those boxes in terms of muscle mass, and also fall within an acceptable criteria of body fat percentage, and that, you know, is if those two sort of physique factors are in check, and then you look at the, you know, metabolic performance, metabolic health of an athlete, how many calories they're consuming in relation to that, how much cardio they're either not doing or doing in relation to that body fat percentage and that overall conditioning. If you look at that and you say, okay, well, this person's good to go, then you could potentially do a prep as early or as little as 12 weeks, which I tend to discourage, and an average of 16 to 20 to 26 weeks. So at Athletic IQ, I try and encourage all my guys to commit to the process for at least 26 weeks. And the reason I do that is because there is that transitional phase between developmental off-season into a comp prep. There's a slight change in how, you navigate through hitting your macros and start to hitting your calories and start to tighten up the reins a little bit as you approach that. So there are a few behavioral changes involved in that. And then obviously there's the non-linear process of losing body fat and I guess for the most part peaking the competitor once they're actually show lean. So if I get someone to, what I would deem to be lean enough to peak, if I get them to that condition, at that point, they don't really look their best. They look flat. They often look, you know, pretty average, to be honest, because usually at that point, you know, we've really sort of stretched the energy gap and they're doing as much work as possible and eating as little as possible or, you know, in the vicinity of as little as they would normally have eaten, for example, in comparison to their normal. And they're as far away from their maintenance set point as possible. So that obviously lends itself to them not looking their best. You know what I mean? They're going to look pretty ragged. They're going to be pretty tired. For the most part, their immune system's probably been dragged through the mud a little bit. You know what I mean? Because that's the furthest point of your diet. Your internet just sort of dropped out then.
Yeah. Same as yours. Just go back just to that last point that you were making.
Yeah. So the bottom line is that when you work with an athlete who is, you know, as lean, you have to imagine that the whole, let's rewind back a little bit. The whole point of bodybuilding is being as lean as possible without dying and as full as possible in the muscle. You know what I mean? And so, being in a situation where you've taken an athlete to that their furthest point generally means that you've stretched the energy gap so much that they're doing so much work, they're doing like their training, you know, if they need to do cardio, they're doing cardio. They're usually at the lowest point of the calories, you know what I mean? They've really dieted and really stretched that diet out to the point where they've been dieting for, you know, chances are up to about 26 weeks, in some cases, you know, even longer. Ideally with diet breaks in between. But, you know, you see my point is that they're really at the tail end of that you know, journey. And at that point, if you put that athlete on stage, they're going to look like crap and they're not going to win the game because yeah. You then need to fill them out and give them enough nutrients, enough carbohydrates, enough glycogen, enough water and sodium to sort of fill that physique out a little bit more for stage without spilling them over. And, you know, that's basically what the game's about in terms of peak week, and that's where there's so many different variables and so many different coaches do things differently at different ways. And I think, you know, one thing that I've learned, you know, in doing this game for so long is that there's no one formula to just pick someone. You know what I mean? Like, you can follow a general gist, but those guidelines will only sort of get you within earshot of truly picking that individual athlete in front of you. You have to be, you know, like if you're talking about properly picking someone, you have to have that sort of intuition, if you like, where you can really look at the physique of the athlete, know what they look like when they're spilt over. You sort of know what they look like when they're sodium flat, yeah. Flat. You know what I mean? Or because the physique looks different when someone is spilt over with sodium or sodium flat, spilt over with carbohydrates or glycogen flat. You know what I mean? So there's all different kind of looks. Has so much water in the system and they're kind of like holding on to some, or whether they're completely dehydrated. You know, there are different that physique, that same lean, drawn down, kind of worn out physique looks very different depending on what variable you play with in the lead up to competition. So
yeah. And I guess that's something that you just pick up over time, just doing it, because you have to have you develop an eye for it in the way one looks versus the other and how to pick that up. And like they say, you know, it's art as much as it is science, like any coaching.
100%. And also, if you think about it from the perspective of powerlifting, right, like with powerlifting, you know, if you write up a strength block, at some point before the next strength block, you'd expect someone to test. Yeah, there'd be a testing phase involved where you test the 1RMs and stuff. And then you put them through another strength block, or if they're happy with their lifts, or if you're happy with where they are, then you start them in the protocol for a prep. In bodybuilding, it's kind of the same if you're clever enough to do it, that when you introduce mini cuts for these athletes in the off season, you know, I hate to say do it this way, because obviously when you do a mini cut, they're not quite lean, like not exactly comp lean, but you can kind of start to play with the variables in the lead up to their competition, is what I'm getting at. And you start to look at what they look like. If you get the competitor ready reasonably early, yeah, for example.
You start to get an idea. You start to get some sort of a picture of the direction you're heading.
Yeah, exactly. And then you can start to go, okay, well, you know, my athlete, like, put it this way, right? Like, if I know that my athlete is sort of, you know, has pulled in early, let's say 4 or 5 weeks early, and competition's 4 or 5 weeks time, they're sort of in the ballpark of being lean enough, I might start getting them to track sodium and see what that looks like when I give them too much You know what I mean? And so see what happens to their physique where it tops out and start to really micromanage certain elements of that scale. Because, for example, in and around that time, what I tend to do is I tend to review. I hardly ever talk food with my clients, to be honest with you. I just talk nutrition. And I'll talk about targets and stuff like that. I'll talk about food for people with very low nutritional competency. But, if they're pretty competent and they're pretty good with what they're doing, I'll just kind of roughly talk about targets and fiber and sodium and stuff like that, right? So, but in and around competition time, for a number of various reasons, one being that, you know, when you're in deep down into a diet, you get a little bit silly, right? So I it's a good time for me to then review what some of these athletes are actually consuming, and then I can review what I try to draw out of that is whether they're sodium heavy, whether they're potassium heavy, what are they using to carb up. Like I had an instance where one of my pros a couple of seasons ago was carving up with just white potato, and dude was lean enough. He was so lean, but he just looked glazed over. He just didn't look quite right to me. I couldn't get that physique to harden up the way I wanted it to. And I was like trying to figure it all out. And like, I just couldn't for the life of me figure out what the hell was going on. And I thought he just looked like he was just a little bit too smooth. For someone who was so lean, I couldn't get the muscle to fill out. And it wasn't because I was hitting the wrong carbs. He wasn't stuffing up his water at all. I looked at his food and he was carving up pretty much cut every type of carb out except for white potato. And I then realized later on that was just really potassium heavy, and it was throwing his electrolyte balance out. So I actually ended up changing his carb source just in time for the competition. He looked pretty damn good when he took the stage. So it's one of those things where every variable does sort of play into consideration. The ones that count mainly are, water, carbohydrates or glycogen, sodium, potassium. So looking at that electrolyte balance. And for the most part.
But these are all like for the real fine-tuning bits of, last like sort of stages and stuff like that, right? Little bit of difference, which can go a long way, by the way.
Absolutely.
To just get the W, and stuff like that. You definitely need a keen eye for, as you have, because you've been doing it for so long. It's been, how long has it been, man? It's been like 8-9 years. You've been doing this like properly, seriously, full on.
So that's an interesting one, because obviously, like everyone who starts in this game, while I wholeheartedly promote a evidence-based approach, and you got to be experienced, you've got to be registered, insured, and all that sort of bit. You've got to be highly qualified to do the job, sort of thing. Like everyone, man, I'll be openly honest about this, is that I had a crack at it when I was just a PT. You know what I mean? Like that's generally speaking, that's what gets everyone into the game. You do a comp and then at some stage someone approaches you about it. You have a crack at it yourself. You usually apply your own, the methods that you learned to the clients that you're working with or the client that you're working with. And you learn from there. That's the initial stages. And I probably did that, I think, maybe 2009 from memory. It was the first client that I helped. Openly, admittedly, not great results. I probably pushed that person's, dietary fatigue to the brink, if you know what I mean. Like, it's not.
Yeah, look, I'll be surprised if any of us, when we first started out, got consistently fantastic results from the very first client we took on. You know, that's
exactly
how you learn.
That's exactly how you learn. Like, I'm not going to be too hard on myself about that. And, you know, I've made many an apology in the past about things that, like, as you learn, you get better and you go, oh, crap, you know, maybe I should have done that better. The number of times I've rang up clients going, hey, let's have another crack at it, because I know now where I screwed up last time, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, there are certain things, like, you know, you learn as you go. Mm-hmm. Even as an evidence-based coach, even like with everything that I've learned from, you know, mentors and books and studies and all that, they're like, when you look back in review, you can, I'm sure there's always clients that, even you, like, you're an amazing coach with powerlifting, but you could probably ring someone up and go, hey, man, I think we need to have another crack at this, you know, because I think, you know, I can improve this part of your training or this part of that program. You know what I mean? Like, you never know. It's just, it's one of those things that I think all of us have, started at some point with inconsistencies, as you said, and you just got to roll with it. So, like I said, 2009, 2010 was my first one. And then I really got into the evidence-based practices around 2012, really got focused on getting much better at my craft. And also something that I think really took me along, like a really long way, was I developed kind of a humility. Like, before that, I was really sort of egotistical in what I was doing, if you know what I mean. Like, my ego was bigger than my capabilities. I was, like, you know, willing to take everything on. And then I got to a stage around 2011, 2012, where I started to realize, hang on, man, you know, not everything you're doing is right. Like, there's some stuff that you could really improve on, and there are certainly coaches out there who are much better than you, and there's some stuff in terms of knowledge that you just flat out don't know or cannot explain, you know. And at that point, I thought, you know, if I'm not the best at it, I'm going to either learn from the best, or I'm going to try and use a referral network of some sort, where it's like, well, you know, the old thing, if you're, you know, when in doubt, refer out, sort of thing. I started to really take that on. I really started to take that on. And I thought, for lack of a better explanation, I really got ethical about what I was doing. I wanted to make sure that I was doing the right thing. And, you know, I think that took me a long way, because, you know, it made me a better critical thinker. And then I started to realize that the people I'm working with as an individual in front of me, they're all different. You know what I mean? And you know, their variables are different. And so, yeah, that's where, you know, that's where things got serious for me around 2012 onwards.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very long time, man. That's a lot of experience. That's, you know, no doubt countless number of competitions and clients put through those competitions. Touched on, you said something about, you know, getting to a point where you thought you got to start expanding your knowledge, and it goes back to the I forget what the actual name of it is. It's a thing where when we start out in something and we don't know anything about it, we acknowledge that we don't know.
Yep.
And as we get to know a little bit more, where we still actually in actual fact don't know, we start to think that we know everything.
Yeah.
And then as we get to really know more and more about it and actually become masters, we go back to thinking, I don't know shit.
Yeah.
And it's like this trend, you know, in pretty much everything.
It's that matrix of competencies and competent learning and that whole learning curve of unconscious competency, you know, conscious competence, unconscious incompetency, conscious incompetency, conscious competency, and then after that will be the last one, will be unconscious competency, where you're actually doing something automatically.
Yeah, which takes, you know, it's a full journey, you know, it takes so long to get to, and you see the pattern, you know, where you look back, like you look alongside at other coaches that are relatively new.
Yeah,
they're not brand new, but they're relatively new, but they kind of that their language and their communication speaks like they know everything.
Uh-oh.
And you can tell that they're at that point of their career. And, you know, it's nothing to like, it's not to put them down or anything like that. It's just the way it is. Like, that's the way it works.
100%, man.
That's the way the human nature is in regards to things, you know. But the sooner you realize that, the quicker you can, I guess, move forward in those stages, to move forward and understand that you need to learn more. And then as you learn more, you realize that you really, or at least you think like you don't know much at all, you know?
Yeah.
And that's important.
I think that's an interesting one because, you know, I think we're forever in this battle with our ego, you know, not to get too philosophical about this thing, but there's, if you get yourself to a certain level, there's two ways to approach it. If your ego is still is too big, and you know, believe me, I'm the first person to tell you, I cringe at some of the shit that I used to say when I was younger. You know what I mean? Like, I actually look back sometimes at my old Facebook memories and then delete some of the old memories because I'm thinking, shit, I don't want to ever see that again. You know? but
yeah, you start to cringe at it.
Oh,
it's
man.
Like. Oh, Jesus, I can't believe I said that, yeah, or I did that or whatever.
It's like, really? Did I really have to make that statement? For what? What was the purpose? Yeah. You know,
it's part of it, man. It's part of that. It's part of the process. It's part of the growth, you know. You got to go through that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think
it's important.
I think even now, I mean, like the other day, something that I realized, a friend of mine who is not a competitor and he's just sort of an enthusiastic lifter, and he messaged me and he sort of, like, I taught him how to track. I taught him how to do everything in regards to all that sort of stuff, tracking macros, calories. And so I became his, more or less, just as a friend, his go-to sort of, you know, guy for questions and whatnot. And he shot me off this thing, which was like this, a review of protein sources, and it was basically a link that was a quote unquote study on, you know, how certain protein powders give you cancer, right? And I was like, at that point I'm like, oh my god, you know. So my initial reaction immediately was like, it was sort of like guard up, and I was like, rolled my eyes.
Mm.
You know, typical thing. Like, I rolled my eyes. I'm like, God, go correct, straight up. And I'm
the
like,
reaction.
Yeah. And I'm like, fuck. Like, really? Do we really have to talk about this? And I'm like, okay, cool. And we had this discussion. And my first question back was, do you drive a car? You know, do you still smoke? Sort of, because I know this guy, like, he used to smoke cigarettes once every blue moon. So I'm like, do you still smoke once a month? You know, and his reaction was like, how can you compare? And this is a genuine thing from a you know, what you would classify as a gen pop, you know, not athlete who lives this every day type thing. It's just genuine curiosity, or beginner to intermediate lifter, you know. And he was like, well, how can you compare my once a month cigarette to doing two protein shakes a day? You know what I mean? And I said, well, it's like this. The way I look at it is, if I'm baking a cake and I run out of baking soda, I'm not going to use Drano. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I'm saying? So I'm not going to go to the cupboard and grab the bottle of Drano and replace my baking soda with it, because, you know, there's baking soda in that, but the devil's in the dosage, you know what I mean? And there's other stuff as well. So So I explained it, and I was a little bit fractionally harsh about the way I explained it. And I thought, do you know what? Like, there's two reasons for that, because the average layperson will not turn around and say, hey, I'm trying to figure out a better way to approach hitting my calories and my macros. I would like to approach it from a holistic perspective and start to look at the type of foods that I'm consuming. I'd start to look at the ratio between whole foods and processed foods. I'm not going to look, you know, they're not going to approach you like that. They're going to ask you one question and it's usually going to sound pretty stupid. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so rather than meeting it with, well, that was well below my level of comprehension, and then meeting it with sarcasm, which was initially the way I interpreted it. I thought, you better back down and answer this the way you would answer a friend, because that's what this guy is. He's a friend.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so, you know, it's an interesting one because, unfortunately, because of social media, the way, and you know, again, here we go. Like, I'm gonna start to. Social media just sort of like has created this environment where everyone, you know, can just fire off comments left, right, center with no context, you know what I mean? And so
and no repercussion.
Yeah, absolutely, no repercussion. And then, yeah, like,
you don't get punched in the face. It's safe. It's behind your computer screen.
Yeah. And also, you know, what tends to happen is people ask things without context, and then it's well within their, you know, their abilities to accept that explanation or decline that explanation. You know what I mean? So, like, there's the old saying in science that which can be refuted without evidence, or, you know, that which can be presented without evidence can be refuted without evidence type thing. And it's just, it's one of those things that, like, most people, they don't really know what to look for when they spit stuff out, so they'll just shoot a question. And then when you say, hey, look, you know, this is what the bulk of the evidence shows, and if you answer it 9 times out of 10, if you answer it properly, unfortunately, because of the way social media is, that it's you're kind of wasting your time, for the lack of a better term.
Mm.
And you just end up in an argument anyway. So I'm just like, you know, I'm always in that sort of place where if someone asks me a question, before just mouthing off, I tend to go, okay, back up, take a breath, chill out, think about it. You know what I mean? Be humble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and it's important, man. Like, it's what it is it's about teaching versus ridiculing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Coaching.
Absolutely.
So instead of coming at somebody with sarcasm and negativity, because this is something that, like, you know, anybody in a position of having been there and done that will do, but it's easy to forget that we were there once as well. You know, we most likely asked our fair share of stupid questions as well from people. and we also got our fair share of sarcastic responses as well.
Absolutely.
But that's just because we got that. That doesn't mean that we should do that, you know. So it's about that teaching versus ridiculing, you know. If somebody is asking a question, obviously they are in search of a knowledge, right?
100%.
So a lot of people, a lot of, like, coaches or people in a position where they do know what they're talking about will ridicule. So it's more about, like, that negativity versus not even positivity, but constructivity.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it's about
giving. Adding something. And giving, as you said, you know, like, because what you tell that person can affect them in a good way, in a positive way, and it can put them on the road towards asking better questions, more questions, and even changing their life in one way or another. You know,
100%, man. And
because for some people, the way they were answered a question inspired them to become a coach, for example. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
So and it's thanks to that person.
In many cases, man, if you approach a thing without ego and with patience, you'll win a fan in many cases, to be honest. I've had a couple of guys that used to troll me who I now prep. You know what I mean? Because Yeah, yeah, yeah. And back in 2012,
yeah, man, like they say, work hard till your haters become your fans. You know, till they just have no reason to hate you. They just got to respect the hustle, respect the knowledge. You know.
Yeah, well,
and that's what it comes down to, and it happens so many times to so many people who are at the top of their game.
And
people hate, and they can hate all they want, but it's not going to stop that person.
It's
going to probably drive them even further.
I'll never forget the one time. There was one time specifically that I was thinking about, and I actually put a little, you know, competitive bet on it. One of the boys who used to troll me hard, and because obviously back in 2012, flexible dieting and tracking macros and all that was just, it wasn't the norm, you know. And then to try and tell someone that you could have flexibility through a prep back in 2012 was just ridiculed. That idea was just crazy. And I remember one of the boys used to just go, like, oh, yeah, so I'm just going to have an ice cream here and there. I'm like, look, how about this, dude? How about if I show you not just the logic behind this, but if I show you in practice that I can not only get you lean, but I can get you to competition and prep in the best way you've possibly ever prepped. In fact, I will cap this with, because I look at your physique and I'm pretty impressed with everything that you've got already, if I can pick you in the best shape possible and we win, you have to pay for the prep. If you lose, I'll do the prep for free. So in other words, I'll do it pro bono. I did this once in my life and he won.
Yeah.
Like, he won the comp. And I was just like,
solid, man.
So it was a good little bet, you know, but I probably wouldn't do that again. considering that everyone.
Yeah, that's tough too, because, you know, he's obviously coming in with this mindset that this thing doesn't work, you know, so you have to work even harder to try and make it happen.
Yeah, but
props to you for doing that.
It's interesting because we knocked that issue out. Within the first 8 weeks, when he started to see his body change, he was sold.
Mm.
He was like, oh, man, this actually works. All right, cool. You know, and I still feel the energy to lift heavy, and I still feel pretty good. It was just, I mean, this whole thing of IIFYM and tracking macros and all that, like, to be honest, what a lot of people tend to really screw up, and I feel where it was losing a lot of its credibility, was when it was being applied by coaches who didn't understand the fundamentals of how to diet someone. They were still getting over dieted. So they were being prescribed the lower end of calories. They weren't being given diet breaks. They weren't, you know, it was just like, here's your macros, here's your calories, and this is your cardio protocol, and this is your training protocol. And, man, people were flogging themselves, even on flexible dieting, so quote-unquote, even on tracking macros, because they were on the wrong, you know, following the wrong nutritional model. You know what I mean? So whereas now there are a lot more people who are, because the standards of the industry have come up, which is amazing and it's awesome. And more people are getting qualified and more people are starting to learn that, you know, you can't just throw someone on a 1,200 calorie and like put them on XYZ protein, carbs and fat split. You know what I mean? Like, and we're in a place now where people are starting to look at, you know, how much the more conservative dieting approach is starting to come through. Where people are actually looking at, for example, they're looking at dieting someone on, you know, as many calories as possible with, you know, what you would classify as sort of a moderate amount of work, like not killing themselves, training to failure all the time, or going as heavy as
possible. Yeah, just crazy amounts of cardio.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, looking at that, that's really starting to make a difference, because the result is that you have a client that ends up adhering to a diet for longer with less effort and actually being healthier along the way. And then, you know, it yields a better result long term. So from a, both a bodybuilding and a powerlifting.
Plus it's more enjoyable, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The whole process is more enjoyable. So they're likely to do it again. If it just sucks and they just wanted to try it once and it just sucks and they're just like, fuck that, I did it, I ticked it off, I don't want to do it ever again, and they just go out of the sport.
Yeah, man.
But at least if they enjoy it, they might be like, okay, that was enjoyable and it was doable. And I mean, it was tough. I mean, I imagine any kind of like last couple of weeks going into a comp is always going to be tough. But that's sport. Right.
Exactly.
But at least it's manageable. They can sort of do it. They know they can do it again and again. You know, it's a good challenge for them.
Absolutely.
Instead of just getting belted, man, in their first experience.
Imagine, you know, if things stayed the way they were, and like back in the 90s and 2000s, like diets were designed in such a way that it's really sustainability wasn't even thought of. It was really how long can I do this before I break? Do you know what I mean? So the diets,
yeah,
the diets, and that's outside of bodybuilding, right? I mean, in bodybuilding, that was hard, that was hardcore, but people did it, and the more intelligent people, you know, who really had, you know, your Meltzers and stuff like that, the people who had a fair understanding of what, you know, what went on, still looked at sustainability. But outside of bodybuilding, the fitness industry in general was like, if you're going to go on a diet, let's follow this one. You know, let's just follow the next fad. And typically speaking, that generally led to crash and burn at some point. And, you know, I think now people are starting to wise up a little bit more. I'm starting to notice that dietary trends aren't as important or aren't on the same platform as they used to be. And I'm starting to see that people are really more looking at what approach, number one, what approach is right for me? That's the first question they ask, which, you know, then leads to, am I eating the right amount of calories? Am I, you know, how much protein am I consuming? Like, these questions are now starting to be asked, even when someone follows a dietary protocol, whether they're vegan, keto, you name it, whatever dietary protocol they go with, they are usually a little bit cluier about how many calories they're consuming and all that sort of stuff, which is good.
Definitely, the standard of information and the availability of information, just widespread to the general public, is like hugely different compared to what it was, you know, not too long ago.
100%.
Which that's really good to see.
How has that changed for you guys in the powerlifting world? I noticed that, like, there were, I mean, even in your own personal experience, coming up to, you know, getting, making weight and all that sort of stuff, I'm sure over the course of the years you would have changed a few things. So do you think there's been a sharp sort of increase in a better way to prep in powerlifting from a nutritional perspective?
From a nutritional perspective, definitely, especially with things like weight cutting. You know, a lot of times people used to go to like really excessive methods of weight cutting, and that would affect strength, you know.
Yeah.
So with, obviously that's different with bodybuilding, as because with strength sports it's performance outcome orientated, right?
Yeah.
So if you're losing too much weight too quickly, that's going to affect things. So weight cutting methods have been improved, but also the understanding of food for fuel, you know, fuel for recovery, how carbs, for example, play a role in that, how protein plays a role in that. The timing of like cutting, if you need to cut versus maintaining versus gaining when you need to gain.
Mm-hmm.
So people have certainly gotten better at understanding those things. Maybe not applied all the time as much as it should be by a lot, because by nature, for example, something like powerlifting is not so like you don't need to be that fine-tuned in regards to how you look compared to something like bodybuilding.
100%.
But those people who are serious, you know, at national level and above, for example, and they really want to get somewhere, they understand it and they utilize it.
Yeah, and
there's certainly room for improvement, and that's up to the coaches and stuff like that to put it out there, which is actually a good reminder. Talking about it right now. it's probably needs to be even more of a push towards that. But it's certainly better than what it was.
Yeah. No, I can see that even over the last few years, you know, in general practices with sort of cutting water and, you know, it's interesting because powerlifting obviously is not only is it a numbers game with weights, but it's a very it's not a subjective sport, right? You're either 83 kilos right. or you're not. You're either and you know, and it's one of those things where you know, coming from your boy who jumped in there and had to take his undies off just to make weight. you know what I mean? I remember when that happened, and I was like, for real? Man, we're talking about like a hairline is like, if you want to compete today, you've got to do what you've got to do. I'm like, okay, undies and socks come off.
Yep.
You know, made weight. And
let's get to it.
Yeah, exactly. But it's one of those things that where you're always kind of you're always trying to refine it, and you know, things like how much sodium to give an athlete, how much water they should be drinking in and around competition so that they can make weight but still make sure that they are able to adhere to the demands of the, you know, meet the demands of the competition, you know, without cramping and stuff like that. It's just it's a fun game to be in. I love this nutrition stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, man. It has so much carryover to so many different things, you know. And in fact, that's some of the stuff that I wanted to go through, hopefully today, if we get the time.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to talk about is the obviously, just like what we're talking about now, a lot more information available out there about just things in general that are evidence-based and you know, research in general,
right.
Just a lot more access to it. What do you think? Do you think that there is almost too much of a push towards, you know, a lot of people, a lot of coaches be like, where's your evidence for that, bro? Where's your evidence for that, bro?
Yeah.
And now it's sort of swung back the other way, almost to the other extreme, where every single thing has to have some kind of a research backing. Otherwise, it's just disproven, discredited, not even listened to, you know. So evidence versus anecdote, you know, if anybody says anything that they believe is anecdotally to be true, to work, they just dismiss it. Do you think that's right? Like, what's your view on something?
Of course, something like that. Of course it's not right, man. Like, I mean, like, again, this is one of those things about social media, right? I strongly believe that there is an over-availability of good quality evidence to the wrong crowd. There's good quality information that's out there, and it's you think of it like rain. It's just, it's everywhere, right, at that one point. And, you know, only a certain group can absorb the right amount of information and the right level of information, because some people aren't quite there yet. The comprehension level we were talking about earlier on is not even close to being able to receive that information just yet. You know what I mean? Some people are still at the comprehension level of, like, I mean, let's just put it this way, right? If you walk into a gym for the first time and you're in 0 to 3 months of training, are we talking about periodization, or do you just need to kind of figure out what RPE feels like? And do you kind of figure out, even before that, maybe just pick up a weight and lift it? Just make sure you're doing it right. You know what I mean? Like, there's three different questions there that address, you know, that address the competency level of the subject. And the problem is, on the internet, there are a lot of people who have a decent comprehension level, but a very, very, because on text it sounds good, but a very poor experience level. So in other words, they probably already read the biochemistry and exercise science, you know, textbooks, and probably pulled out and pulled out, you know, every kind of study there is on the internet. But the problem is, they've just, in most cases, they've just used Google. And
and read the abstract.
Exactly. They've read an abstract and they classify research to be whatever Google spits out, you know, and they haven't practiced. So that's a deadly concoction, because you basically have someone who has no understanding or respect for the type of evidence that's available, so the hierarchy of evidence. They have no respect for that, right? So, you know, they'll value expert opinion just as high as a meta-analysis, for example, right? In most cases, that's the case, right? Because Kai Greene said on, you know, on Instagram this, so that must be right. Mm-hmm. And then you couple that with a really poor experience, entry-level experience, and you've got someone that's basically firing blanks. You know what I mean? You've got someone that's in our era would have been called out for talking shit. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? Because the thing is, the thing is, like, you need some sort of comprehension level from an experience, from experience, not from just, you know, looking at textbooks and stuff. And the issue is, in this day and age where everyone has a platform to speak, and some people, you know, aren't exactly qualified to do that, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, everybody's got a platform, exactly as you said. And that's not bad in of itself. It's just the use of it in different contexts and circumstances and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, you know, when you've got in front of you a clear re-emerging pattern of, you know, when I do squats three times a week, there's an improvement in my squat with this type of a person. Mm-hmm. And there's, just because there's no research out there showing that 3 days of a week of squatting is good, or 3 days a week squatting is bad for the knee, or is bad for the nervous system, or whatever. I mean, but the evidence is in front of you. There's this particular thing telling you right now, you're seeing it again and again. You're just going to ignore that.
Yeah.
And you're going to say, well, you know, anecdotal evidence doesn't count because I don't have any research to back this up. So because there's no research, it's disproven.
You know,
and I think that's you can miss so much gold like that.
100%. And to the point that you were talking about, sort of increasing frequency to improve the squat, there's, you know, in so many places and so many things, that there's more than just a strength progression on paper. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's skill, there's being comfortable, there's like just getting to improve something because you're doing it. Like, you know.
Yeah, sorry, Paolo, just cut out there for a second. You were saying.
Yeah, so all I was saying was that basically, you know, there are so many things that aren't available on paper that improve in practice, you know what I mean? If you increase the frequency of the squat, as you were mentioning before, you know, we're not just talking about the logical progression of a periodization model on paper. There are certain factors that will help you improve as well. Your coordination, being comfortable under the bar, overall your skill, your comfort level, all the cognitive things that you recognize as you kind of, as you execute that movement, you know, you start to sort of sit back and go, okay, well, I know how this feels now. I'm getting more familiar with this. Familiarity has a huge role to play in improving things, and it's very hard to measure. It's very hard to measure for most people, you know what I mean? So from an athletic perspective, what I used to say to guys was, when people go, oh, you know, well, why are we doing it this way? You know, shouldn't we And that's cool. I like those sort of questions. You know, shouldn't we do it this way instead of that way, even before you've tried it? I'm cool with that. But I always sort of bring it back to a really simplistic approach that was taught to me when I started PT. And I'll never forget, it was called the shotgun theory for RPE, right? So it was sort of what they said was, let's say someone said, hey, I want you to do 10 reps of lat pull down, for example, and I want you to pick a weight that you fail at 10 and not go to 12. And, you know, for the most part, a lot of people kind of don't know what that is when they first start. Mm-hmm. And then they say, well, you know, imagine I had a shotgun pointed at your head and I said to you, I want you to do an extra 2. Like, you failed at 10, right? Because most people come back with, yeah, I'm done, I'm cooked. You pull the shotgun out, do another 2 reps. And if you can do another 2 reps, then you weren't really at 10 RPE for the 10 reps for that weight. So, you know, that the same concept can be said with regards to what you were talking about earlier on with the squatting. Like, if a hitman came up to you and said, hey, man, here's the deal, right? In a month, I'm going to come back. Well, let's use 3 months, the 12-week process. In 12 weeks, I'm going to come back, and I'm only interested in seeing your squat improve. If your squat does not improve, I have to pull the trigger. That's the contract, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the question begets then, if that was the actual situation you were in 12 months, a hitman's coming back and they're going to shoot if your squat doesn't improve, how many times a week do you squat?
Every day.
You know what I mean? Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly the case, right? Most people would say, shit, man, I'm going to squat every day.
Yeah. Better practice.
It's one of those things that, like, it's a very raw and, you know, that's not an evidence-based question. Like, that's an experience-based question. You know what I mean?
That one's purely anecdotal, that one.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, the thing is that raw primal instinct kicks in and goes, shit, man, I've just got to do this. And I think that, you know, we were discussing this the other day when we caught up. I think that there's that primal instinct that sort of goes out the window these days a little bit because of the dawn of social media and so many people having opinions on things that they haven't tried or that they're not necessarily directly involved in, or that they're not. I mean, people like you and I are crucially, like, we're insanely passionate about what we do. Yeah. I mean, I think that's fair to say. Like, you're crazy about getting people to the platform in the best way possible. And I'm crazy about getting people to the stage in the best way possible. Like, we're nuts about that. Like, I don't sleep sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'll think about different stuff. I'll read stuff, you know, and I'm sure you do the same. The thing is, and I know because I've talked to you at that time, but the thing is that people who comment on this sort of shit, 9 times out of 10, that they haven't even stepped in the gym long enough to even make that comment. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, I take that with a grain of salt, right? In this day.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
I just think
it's just everybody's got that platform, you know, and they want to use it whether they're right or wrong. They don't stop to think, but that's fine, man. Like, it is what it is, right? But just because you have an opinion doesn't mean it's the right one.
Absolutely, man. And you've got to try it out. Like, at the end of the day, you know, I've said many, many things that are in agreement with evidence-based practices, but when they hold up to practice, I'm just like, you know what? You do you. So, for example, the protein shake theory, you know, I've explained this many, many a time. You got a bodybuilder that comes from a rigid background, you know, your typical bro science bodybuilding background, right? And they've been lifting for years. And typically speaking, as they're walking out the gym, they crack open a protein shake and they just slam it down. All right. So you've got this guy that's got a rigid, you know, Monday to Friday or Monday to Saturday workout regime. And every day after training, within 3 minutes, they're slamming down the protein shake. In the back of their head, they're going, okay, well, that's because, you know, it helps me with my gains, or it helps me with my muscles, or whatever they want to call it, right? So that's clearly not in line with what the available information says they need to be doing. So available information says that you don't need to, have such a rush post-workout for your, to meet your training window. Anything 4 to 6 hours, you can eat a meal, you can have your protein shake within 4 to 6 hours of lifting, peri or post-workout, and you'll be fine. You'll still actually trigger, muscle protein synthesis, for example. Mm-hmm. But let's just say, from a practice perspective, you told the bodybuilder that that's the case, and you challenged them to stop drinking their protein shakes immediately after training. Well, from a behavioral perspective, it's possible that, at some stage there'll be a behavioral breakdown, and then all of a sudden they're going from, having a really good, meal timing, if you like, sort of hitting their macros, hitting their calories, a really good schedule, a rigid schedule, to they're getting hungry and they're falling out of adherence, by not doing that protein shake after training, which I've been doing for 20 years, for example. All of a sudden, now I'm in a relaxed state of mind, too relaxed, and my on-off switch is now off, and I'm just going to go for Maccas tonight. You know what I mean? Mm. So in that case, from a practice perspective, I'm better off saying, man, yeah, you don't have to, but if you're comfortable doing it, just go ahead, right ahead and do it. I don't care. It's not hurting you.
100%, man. I've noticed this as well, even with myself. When you allow yourself to break discipline, it mm-hmm. leaks into other areas and other things. Just because you know that the science says you can lump, I don't know, two workouts together, for example, right?
Yeah.
And Monday you're a little bit tired and you're like, I'm a little bit tired today. And the science says I can lump my Monday workout with my Tuesday workout. So I'm just going to go tomorrow and do it. Tomorrow you're not going to lump the Monday workout with the Tuesday workout, even if the science says so. You've just broken discipline. Just go and do the Monday workout,
Absolutely,
And that just, it's just this domino effect where just one thing leads to another, where you're like, oh, this is okay because I can do it this way because so-and-so told me or such-and-such study proves it or whatever. Yep. It's not always about studies and science and research. There's, at some point, you need to also be a little hard on yourself. You need to push yourself a little bit past the particular expectation, a little past the limit. Just because something is hard, you shouldn't try and find an easier way out. You should be happy that it's hard, and meet that challenge. And it's the same thing with that protein shake thing. It's working for the guy, and it's that discipline has been developed and built in. He's doing it. So just because he doesn't have to get it post-workout, just let him get it post-workout. What's the bad thing about getting it post-workout? Now you're giving him an excuse. You're planting a seed of excuse in the mind that if I miss it, doesn't matter. I can get it later. It doesn't, exactly. Man. It doesn't. You're ruining that structure.
Exactly. And so it's really about identifying the strengths of what the athlete's been working with, and especially, and what you were saying before is just developing that competitive streak in an athlete. And if that athlete is used to sort of mentally conditioning themselves by putting themselves through a little bit of rigidity, or a lot of rigidity, whatever, it's not always wise to just lump information and studies at this person. You know what I mean? I've had clients who have struggled, with other coaches who have been purely information driven, very good, very, very good, highly qualified coaches. Don't get me wrong, right? And I wouldn't obviously bag out on them. But what it is that sometimes, you know, when you put the information before the person, you put the process before the individual, it can affect how that individual reacts from a behavioral perspective. Because at the end of the day, they're the ones that have to implement everything that you're doing. So, for example, if I have an athlete that comes back to me and says, hey, you know, I'm having a bad week and I don't want to jump on the scales this week, for example, I'm not going to demand that. You know, there are other ways to measure progress that week, right? Depends on the context of what we're doing. But obviously, like, you know, in powerlifting, if you got that a week before comp, you'd probably say it's a bit crucial. But, you know, what my point is, I've seen practices from, again, very good coaches where they get their clients. Are you there? You with me?
Yeah, just go back to just what you said. The problems, yeah. I've seen, and then
yeah, cool. So I've seen clients come back to me, and they've struggled with coaches who have gotten them to weigh in every day, or you know,
yeah,
you know, take weight every day, take measurements, record every single bit of volume from accessories to main lifts to everything else, record the intensity of cardio, the heart rate, the calories burnt, the speed they're doing their cardio at, the hours and time and minutes that they're doing it, and just micromanaging everything to that point. And I've seen this, you know, 26, 30 weeks out of comp in an off season, and you know, often there are more repercussions, negative repercussions when you do stuff like that, because you're putting the process before the individual. You're putting the, you know, you're coaching the process. You're not coaching the person. And so I'm a big believer in sort of trying to figure out from not just an evidence-based perspective, but also a philosophical and psychological perspective, what drives that athlete, right? And kind of working out where their strengths are. And like you said, if I've got a guy who's a little bit old school, and for the past 20 years, the only way they get themselves to stay committed to the process, or they get a better training session in because they drink BCAA, for example. You know, I'm a bit like that. I used to drink, even after the evidence showed that BCAA was, you know, kind of like flavored water, I enjoyed a BCAA in my session. And you know what? For a while, I still kept drinking it till I ran out and I didn't want to waste my money anymore. But the bottom line was, yeah, psychologically, I was like, yeah, you know, I mean, I've been doing this for a while. I know the taste. I know that when I'm drinking that stuff, I wouldn't drink it in front of the computer. If I'm drinking that stuff at the gym, I'm going to train a little bit harder. All right, cool. Just keep doing it. You know, so psychologically and philosophically, sure, I'll look at that individual and say, okay, well, you know, how can I drive this athlete to make improvements without, you know, flipping the whole world around, you know, that's what,
yeah,
I look
just
at.
It's just about adherence, man. You know, that's just the dominating factor. Whatever gets you to adhere, as long as it's not harmful, there's
absolutely,
sometimes there's no need to remove it. You know, if you're having BCAAs and it doesn't do anything, fine, but it doesn't, does it actually stop you from making improvements, making progress, building muscle? No, it doesn't. So the only thing that you need to understand is if you want to keep doing it, it's potentially a relative waste of money. You happy with that? Are you accepting of that? Cool. Keep going.
Yeah. Most people are exactly like that. They're happy to you know. Most people who I coach, if they have a protein shake that's been sitting, you know, above their cupboard that they haven't necessarily used to meet their protein requirements this month, they're not going to cry. They just know it's there as a safety, like a, you know, like a last minute resort thing. And if that's what they feel like, if they're spending $100 on that, you know, safety blanket, and that they're comfortable with that, go for it, man. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah. And to your point about the whole competitive, you know, nature and adherence of an individual, I mean, I still believe that as coaches, our job is to create an environment where a client can adhere to something with as little effort as possible, right? And what I mean by that is, obviously, I'm not going to put constructs in where I want you to eat your meal standing on one leg with one arm above your head, you know. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to make it difficult for you to adhere to the plan. I'm going to make that as simple and as easy as possible. But we also have to identify that athletes want to struggle a little bit. You know what I mean? Let's grit our teeth and just struggle, you know, because now I know I'm working. And when you've got that, you have to work with it, especially the great ones, the ones that are hyper competitive, man, that you have to harness that. You have to actually, to a degree, you have to.
You definitely got to go. You got to cultivate it. You can't push that down. There's some people who want really hard ass coaches, you know, and if that's what they want, then that's what you got to be, you know, to get the most out of them. It's just they're genuinely like that, you know. Yeah, maybe far and few in between, but they definitely exist. They're out there. And you got to understand what makes your own individual client and athlete tick. And if you can find that out, then you got to use that. And some people are the opposite. You know, they need to be a little bit more, you need to be gentle with them a little bit more and stuff like that. And it's up to you as the coach to, first of all, decide if you're going to be like that and, you know, be accommodating to different types of personalities, because some coaches don't care. They're just one way. And they're like, if you don't like the way I am, don't work with me, sort of thing. And others are flexible. You know, they can work with different personalities.
Absolutely, man.
I want to ask. I know you got to go as well. Don't want to take up much of your time, but I wanted to go into so much as we were talking. I'm just writing notes here, and might have to save some of this for like a part two. But in kind of coming to slowly a close, I'll ask this: in your experience, you've been doing this for a very long time. For people who want to not necessarily become bodybuilders, like step on stage, but, you know, develop an impressive physique, what are some of the main mistakes, say 3 to 5 very common mistakes that you see people make with either their nutrition or their training, either or, in any mix, in any way that you like, in no particular order?
Yeah, okay, cool. So depending on their experience level, the first one I'll bring up is training to failure each and every session. That, to me, and obviously that shines through in your field as well, like in your specialty, training to failure every session in the beginning might have its place because you've got to figure out where you fail. But, you know, after a while, after you've gone through that pain, that soreness and all that, it's just pain and soreness for the sake of it. So training to failure every session rather than actually sort of recognizing the difference between training and testing, where they're actually working at a sort of 8 to 8.5 RPE, that sort of thing, you know what I mean? So where you've got an individual that's doing that and then, you know, proper periodization from there. So definitely that's one thing. That's a huge mistake because it plateaus really quickly. From a nutritional perspective, I think not recognizing, I mean, the most obvious one is not recognizing and prioritizing energy balance, right? That's the most obvious one. There are so many people out there that still chase the nutritional fad diet, the approach, rather than the caloric balance, right? So, in my experience, that's a huge mistake when trying to sort of, you know, progress in this game. It's like, if you're just going to look at, you know, does paleo even still exist? But let's say paleo or keto or or something like that, versus how many calories should I be on? What am I achieving by being on these calories? Like, is that a gain? Is that a maintenance, or is that a deficit? Is it an aggressive deficit, or is it just a conservative one? You know, things like that. Like, that's a huge misconception where people don't recognize the difference between, what approach they should be taking and how many calories they should be consuming. That's another thing.
Mm.
The third thing I would say is actually having this premature hyper-aggressive attitude towards a deficit or a gain. So most people, a little bit is good, so more must be better, right? So, you know, I noticed that this month I was in a bit of a surplus and I gained some muscle. So next month I'm going to double that. You know what I mean? And then, like, 2 months later, like, they're fat. you know what I'm saying? So there's that aggressive mentality that's too premature. Like, the only time you should ever get aggressive, in my view, with certain things, like, for example, like you're an aggressive deficit, is if you're kind of behind the target with your, for your comp, with your body fat loss. There might be a stage there where we have to get a bit more aggressive than what's outlined in the books. And that's all within consideration of, you really have a deadline there. You can only get aggressive or that aggressive for 2 to 4 weeks. Like, you're not going to put someone through an 8-week 1,000 calorie diet. Like, it's just stupid. Do you know what I mean? So these are things that people really miss out on. They're just a bit too aggressive too early. That's a huge mistake. And then I think the final ones that I've noticed is, in terms of, like, not recognizing where they're at in the process, it's very easy for someone to kind of, like, jump in, especially in my game, where they go, hey, you know, they're a little bit too eager to get on stage. Hey, I want to do a prep with you. I want to start this prep, and I want to do the comp in, say, you know, in 6 months' time or 5 months' time. And, you know, can we start that? And you look at them and it's like, dude, I can't even work with that yet. You need to put in some time. You need to develop overall hypertrophy. You know what I mean? Because if I cut from here, your conditioning will suffer. Yeah, I can get you lean, but you won't like what's under the quilt. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The development's not there yet. That basic command of development and just laying down muscle tissue. At that particular point, they're not realistic enough to know where they are and how long it takes to be where they are, right?
Yeah, that's a huge factor, and often that comes hand in hand with specifically in my field. Again, the thing I don't understand is, in this field, it really attracts a lot of people that go, hey, I want to do a prep. I am so passionate about bodybuilding. I love bodybuilding. I love the idea of getting on stage in my bikini, my heels, or in my trunks or whatever. I want to get on stage. Okay, cool. What category do you want to do? Oh, I don't know. Can you tell me? Like, I don't know anything about categories. I don't know anything about anything. I just like bodybuilding. And it's like, would you do that in powerlifting? Like, would I ever walk up to you as a coach and say, I'm so passionate about powerlifting, I can't wait to do a snatch. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It just doesn't make sense to me. That's the one thing that, like, this game kind of attracts that individual that goes, and, you know, I guess maybe it's all the bright lights and the shiny things, you know what I'm saying? But it's just, to me, I just don't get someone that says, man, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get on that stage. Like, I'm willing to put in the work and go through the hard times, get on that stage because I love the game. Okay, can you, like, tell me what category you're aiming for? What category? I thought it was just the stage. Like, it legitimately spins me out. So in that,
why do you
in
think that
regard,
is, man? What do you think that comes from? What does that happen? You reckon
that, like, okay? So in our sport has a very interesting dynamic. It tends to help people bring out confidence where there was previously a lack of, right? I mean, realistically, I think every sport kind of does that anyway, but this would be the most obvious, you know, because a lot of people are trying to solve probably gaps in their lifestyle.
Yeah, some kind of a void, fill the void in some way. It's probably like a fairy tale thing, you know, they tell themselves or they imagine in their mind to step up.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, where you had that with a 300-kilo deadlift, you know what I mean? You were like, forget about the stage. My fairy tale is I need to lift that bastard off the ground. Like, that just has to come off. And, you know, more people, not everyone has what you had. Not everyone wants to do that. It's just not in their scope. Like, pulling a heavy weight off the ground, in my view personally, I'd love to see more people want to do that, but the reality is that it's more obvious and more in your face and more, you know, I'm going to use the word glamorous, you know, to have someone under lights in stripper heels, in a bikini, walking through, you know, wings on their back, that kind of thing. You know, it might sound a little bit jaded, but the reality is that in that process, it gives people a lot of attention along the way. Do you know what I mean? Where you can, it's a lot of Instagram content, dude. you know what I'm saying? It's so So there is that, and then out of that, so out of that following, there are the few and far betweens that we were discussing before, the outliers who love this game, who are either as passionate as me or more passionate about it, where they're like, they really want to excel. They can't sleep until they figure out a better way to do things. You know, that's the stuff.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting game.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And those are some good points, especially a couple of them, you know, very relatable and applicable to the majority of people out there, even if they don't want to ever jump on stage to compete in bodybuilding, but they're just chasing, you know, physical development and cultivation goals.
Yeah.
We in closing, I want to ask you a couple of things because you're somebody who's obviously been doing it for a very long time, and you've had you and Athletic IQ, which is your company, has done really well over the years, and no doubt over those years you would have picked up and learned more about, you know, business development and stuff like that. What are some productivity tips that you've got for the people listening, and even for myself? I'm always after just things like that to improve productivity, improve just work rate and achievements and stuff like that. What are some top productivity tips that you've picked up over the years?
I think, first and foremost, thank you for suggesting or even saying that, you know, AIQ's done really well, and I'm, you know, I agree that it has, given that I'm in a situation where I haven't physically advertised since 2015, like I haven't paid for an ad or anything like that. My first tip to anyone in business is do something that you're, number one, I know this sounds cliche, but do something you're passionate about, and find that when you find that craft, you want to master it. You just don't want to, don't just do it because you like it and you're one of the guys, you know, that who offer that service. Find your niche, find the people you want to speak to, speak their language, speak at their level, and then master the craft and literally just be the go-to person for that craft, that specific craft. And there in that niche, there's usually a sub-niche of sorts, you know what I mean? Like it's not just I like bodybuilding, right? There are 1,000,001 bodybuilding coaches. But me personally, I work on an individual level with a lot of bodybuilders who have the serious goal of turning pro and then using their platforms to actually improve their business or start their own business as an athlete. You know what I mean? So you can tell the difference between, hey, I want to just put everyone to stage, or I want to actually work with the best of the best and put them on stage, if you know what I mean. So there's that. There's the niche and the sub-niche thing. So knowing that, knowing how they speak, knowing how they interact, knowing what level of energy they bring to the table, and how, and being able to meet that and speak to that and manage that, that's a thing. That's actually a deal. So it's mastering that. And then the second thing is, in terms of being efficient, from a very basic perspective, and it's something that I'm still sort of learning, is time management. Putting in constraints where you aren't in a position, especially on an online space, where you're not in a position where you're like having to respond to messages at 2 a.m. when an overseas client messages you, you know, and putting in all the constraints and having the systems in place and being organized enough so that you can deliver a high level of service and you know, provide a construct where you're creating raving fans, where you're creating fans who are like not just happy clients, you know what I mean? I've always said I don't want happy clients. I want crazy, raving, stark naked fans who are just nuts, where they just talk about us all the time because they're happy, because they're very, very happy, you know what I mean? Where they're seeing results, this is in this environment, this is the best they've worked with. That's what I want. I want to create that. So I have to make sure that the systems in place allow me to do that, because if I didn't have any systems in place, when I have a bad day, I deliver bad service. When I have a good day, I deliver good service. You know, and you can't have that sort of flailing expectation where one day I'm giving a crap answer and the next day I'm like giving way too much because I'm operating at the next level. So, you know, I want to make sure that the systems in place, such as education points, contact points, engagement points, things like that, is already kind of, for lack of a better word, the construct is already pre-done. So it's easy for me to get in contact with these guys. So there's that. And then, so it's about having the right platform to do that. And then finally, from a small business owner who has managed to scale it to the point where we've, you know, like you're like yourself, we've got a couple of coaches or whatever, you've got to work on, you've got to have a day where you work on the business and you're not working in it. If you don't have that and you're not thinking about the on the business stuff, like you'll go nowhere. You'll just be stuck and you'll always just kind of go in circles. You know what I mean? I learned that last year, where I was just like, okay, you know, Fridays, yeah, I'll get back to a couple of clients. Yeah, I might make a client call, but for the most part, I'm not logging in to anything. I'm working on my business and just kind of figuring out what's next, figuring out, you know, where we can improve.
That's an important one. Where a lot of people, you know, we get stuck in and don't do that, you know. That's very important. Yeah. One.
Especially for PTs. Yeah, a lot of PTs, like from a business perspective, man, like I notice a lot of PTs, they did what I did when I was first doing PT, you know, which is like book yourself out till your eyeballs roll back in the back of your head. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Start at 5:30 a.m. work till 10 at night, Monday to Friday, and then work Saturday mornings. And then why?
You can't move that way. You can't.
Yeah, absolutely not. It takes you a few months to figure it out. Like, you know, you have a few good weeks there where you're like, "Yo, I can make some money, man." But then you realize you're burning the candle at both ends, and
100%.
Oh, dude, it's just, yeah, I can't even begin to tell you how bad that ended for me. So that's a discussion for another day.
Yeah, I think we've all been there, man, at one point or another. And that's why, you know, we are where we are now in regards to, you know, pretty much the opposite end of that, understanding that we need to, as we say, have systems, good time management, stuff like that, and just be more productive and leverage time a little bit better. So that's very important. And I think maybe to some degree we have to go through that crap to actually experience it, so we understand that we never ever want to go through that crap again. We don't even want to see it at a distance. So yeah, that's actually good recommendations there. Any good? What are some good resources you'd recommend for people who want to learn more about either nutrition and diet, bodybuilding, you know, hypertrophy or muscular development? Where are your go-tos? Where would you recommend people start on if they want to start learning about these kind of stuff?
Well, for starters, I mean, there's before we go on to all the reviews and all that sort of stuff, there's you, right? So you put out some really good local information that's, you know, it's straightforward and simple, easy to understand, really good tips and sort of put in a way that's, you know, it's effective, if it's experience-based and evidence-based, and then it's easy to understand. That's so straightforward, you can apply it. That's the stuff that, to me, that counts a lot, rather than just going, here, I want you to
look
at this study, you know what I mean? So, all right, so there's that. And then Eric Helms, Dr. Eric Helms from 3DMJ has MASS. He does that with, I believe it's Eric Tressler, mm-hmm. Andy Morgan. So they've got a monthly review that I wholeheartedly recommend. They look
likewise,
at
yep.
yeah they look at training and nutrition. I think it's a subscription service, but it's worth it in my view. And then there's Alan Aragon as well. The AARR monthly review. He puts that out more on nutrition than training. So if you're in that sort of, and that what I find is with MASS, it's more appropriate to like powerlifting and bodybuilding. And with AARR, it's sort of a little bit more skewed towards general pop in terms of the information that comes out. Although it's pretty high level stuff, you know, I recommend his work too. Obviously there's Lane Norton who, you know, for the most part sort of, mentored me, I guess, in my early years in this game. And, he puts out some good information too. So I would look at those three as a starting point. And then, you know, if you get more advanced from there, there's obviously like Mike Tushara, Mike Zordos in the training, on the training side of things, who I believe you work with Mike Tusher. He's amazing. Like his information is second to none.
He's definitely very very cerebral, very very thoughtful. He's an excellent coach. Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So there's that sort of stuff. And from a bodybuilding perspective, you know, there's pretty much there's very little resources for bodybuilding, but like I said, Dr. Eric Helms is probably, I would say, one of the leading sources that I look at for natural athletes specifically. That has to be said, because he really does focus on working with non-enhanced athletes. Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, I mean, there's definitely got to be a part two to this, because there's a lot of stuff that I want to talk about in relation to actual training and centered around protein absorption and refeed days and stuff like that. So I think we can definitely do that again if you're free again down the road.
For sure, man.
But thank you for your time. I mean, this was still packed full of information. Some really good stuff we went through, and it was good to sit down with you to get firstly an update on what's going on around the grounds, and also just to have a chat, man. It's been a while.
Absolutely. So maybe next time we call on a Sunday night and we bring some whiskey into the mix.
100%, man. All right, Pete, thanks a lot, man. Oh, before we go, where can people reach you if they need to ask you questions, get on board with some coaching and programming and training and stuff like that? Just run us through that.
Absolutely. You can check me out on Instagram at athletic_IQ, so at athletic_IQ, or on my website, www.athleticiq.com.au, or just hit me up on Facebook. Athletic IQ is on Facebook, as well as, you know, myself, Paolo, that's Paolo, Baja is my surname, Baja, and I'm the head coach and founder of my company, Athletic IQ, and we're pretty easy to find.
Easy. All right. Thanks, Paolo. Really appreciate it, man. Thanks for the chat.
No worries, boss. Good to speak to you again. And we'll definitely organize that part two, because I'm keen to put some info out there.
Definitely, man. Definitely. Coming up. Cheers, brother.
Take care. Talk soon.